The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Hello and welcome to today's Thought Leader interview. I want to thank you all for joining us today, and I want to give a big thank you to Brian Standen, who has agreed to be interviewed. As Head of Scouting and Partnerships, Digitalization of R&D at BASF, Brian is responsible for building collaborations with academic institutions, early stage ventures, and established companies to strengthen BASF's digital capabilities, enabling the continuous advancement of science. He is currently focused on the role of digitalization in sustainability and how the enormous volumes of data available may still not be enough of the right data to enable the broad changes cutting-edge data science techniques offer. I'm Lee Green, and I run IRI's strategic initiatives. This interview is an element of IRI's digital transformation community. The DXC is a community of organizations that are on the journey toward digital transformation. Through the DXC, you can access case studies with fresh, relevant content. The first one on Michelin is available on our website, and the next one on USG is due in just a few short weeks. A conference dedicated to digital transformation, Digital Futures, will be taking place October 12th to the 14th in Cleveland, Ohio, in conjunction with Case Western Reserve University. We also offer facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics, updates with insights and additional resources, workshops to take deep dives on shared pain points, and webinar interviews with thought leaders like we are doing today. These always take place on the third Thursday of the month at 12 p.m. Eastern, and next month we will be talking to Ananth Krishnan, the CTO of Tata. I'll be sure to sign all of you up to receive updates on the DXC. If you do not wish to receive updates, just let me know. I have a few housekeeping items to get through before we can begin our conversation with Brian. First, this session is being recorded, and you will get a link to the recording. We will be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there will be no visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. Once we open the floor to questions, you can either raise your hand using that function on the dashboard, at which point I will unmute you so you can ask your question, or you can type your question in and I will read it out for you. Let's get started. Right, Brian. So what do you think is key to BASF's digital strategy?
Lee, thanks for having me, and thanks to everybody for coming. I appreciate the opportunity to do this. Your question is a big one, as I've considered it. In thinking about it, I think maybe I want to limit the scope just a little bit because of my role. I would think and try to answer this primarily from a digitalization of R&D perspective, because the digital strategy of BASF is broader than just R&D, but I would say that what's really key to this is people. And though that might seem sort of like a generic answer, let me see if I can elaborate a little bit on that. There are multiple types of people that are involved to make this happen, right? Tools and tech are only one element of this, and honestly, in the current environment, it's not hard to find tools and tech. Now, tools and tech that work and tools and tech that actually fit to your need, maybe that's another story, but you know, the exponential rate at which technology is evolving, you can find those things. What's harder, I think, is finding, is moving people into a digital mindset in making that cultural shift. We have to adopt new ways of thinking. We have to challenge ourselves and sort of preconceptions on what we really think is digital enabled versus digitally driven, or maybe I could rephrase that as data enabled or data driven decisions. And oftentimes that's hard for people to shift, right? People usually see data as enabling what they already either presuppose or potentially want to go in a particular direction, and so the data helps to support that. But it's another thing to think that the data would actually just guide the way you think about something. So I think that's a challenge, and you need people who are open to that. I think another element of people is that, you know, what we see a lot in the news these days is primarily about job replacement, but you don't hear a lot of people talking about job augmentation, which I think is another really critical component of what we're doing and sort of plays into my first point. When you think about the ways that people's jobs will transform, there will be augmentation of roles based on digitalization. So tools for efficiency, tools that help you to make decisions and data, that really can help to drive the way you think about things, will will not replace necessarily what you do, but can maybe take away some of the elements of what you do that aren't as necessary for a mind to think about. And so to me, I think that that's critical. So helping people to understand that. And then lastly, I think people who are purveyors or who are practitioners in this space, right? We wouldn't be anywhere without our data scientists. We wouldn't be anywhere without the people who do understand the tech. So we really need subject matter experts to help drive that. So at the end of the day, you know, digitalization is, I think, often seen as simply about ways in which you can take technology and apply it to these pristine data sets that you have inside your organization, and you're going to find that needle in a haystack. But at the end of the day, it all is still driven by people, and you need people to be a part of that journey and supporters of how you get to the end goals that digitalization can lead you to.
All right. Yeah, we've been hearing that a lot lately, especially last month from Jerry Kane. He made very similar points. So that's really driving it home. So what's the biggest success that you've had?
Yeah, I thought about this one a lot because I actually would dial this a little bit back, because I think at the end of the day, it's not big successes. It's actually a lot of small successes. One of our most visible successes, I think, is our supercomputer Curiosity. So we did build our own, and we have that internally. And I think that is a great tool for our science and for what we can do and how we move forward and accelerate our R&D efforts. So that's probably one of the most visible. But we have all these little successes that I think I would categorize in big success because of the type of impact that they have on the projects that they support. So, for example, one example that I use pretty regularly is we used computer vision techniques to actually read the contents of a Petri dish, right? And what it did was it would do sort of counts, and it would give you organization. And you can run this through the camera. You take pictures of it, and it would turn it into a visualization for somebody to look at. And what we found was that doing that, applying that technology to that particular problem, actually helped to increase our overall efficiency in that respect by, I think it was 90% is what I saw. And it would remove a good deal of bias, right? So we have operator bias, as somebody was maybe counting things manually or distinguishing things manually. The algorithm of the system that was doing this actually doesn't tend to exhibit that particular bias, right? Not that systems aren't biased, because I'm sure somebody might ask me that, because that certainly is the case. But in this case, it actually removed operator bias quite a bit and helped with efficiency. And here again, that plays back into my original point about augmentation, is that here we're augmenting a role, right? We're replacing work that actually can be done better and faster by a machine, and taking that person and allocating them to other things that machines don't do well. I think that's a nice story. And so in my view, that's a big success.
All right. So what are the biggest challenges you faced?
those go back to people too. my theme. Technology challenges are always there. I tend to believe that most technology challenges you can get around for the most part. I think I would say there's two, and I'll give one tech, and then I'll, of course, going back to my theme with people, I'll kind of give another one there. So in the technology realm, especially in my role, separating hype from reality is really difficult. I used to kind of joke with some of my other scout colleagues and say, you know, I meet more people who have the model that's going to fix every problem we have, or the algorithm that has never been conceived of before that would change everything we do in the chemical industry on a pretty regular basis. And it's humorous, but it's true, right? Because we have this hype cycle where there's a lot of people who believe that machine learning can do anything and everything. I'm not saying at the end of the day that there isn't some truth to that, because I think we're in a phase of digitalization that's very different from perhaps previous phases, where artificial intelligence and machine learning had a lot of hype, a lot of promise, and just never delivered. I think here we're actually seeing that delivery, and that's actually been going on rather quietly in the late 2000s, and then drew a lot more attention as we moved into the 2010s. So I think there's more legs to this and will be longer, but that doesn't mean everybody has it. And so how do you navigate that and really assess what's real and what's not? And we have ways, and that comes back to people, because we do need those subject matter experts that I referred to before in the digital area to help us vet out whether that works. I think another way that we also very strongly think about vetting out these technologies is, especially as a science-driven organization, is that empirical testing helps us to validate the digital prediction or the digital find. So we still rely on our wet lab colleagues, but at the end of the day, we hopefully do less of those, right? That's sort of our driver. I think the other challenge when it comes to people, and then this isn't about augmentation as I talked about before, but I think there's skepticism, right? You know, being a science-driven organization, we have oftentimes this deep skepticism about new technologies and or revisions of existing technologies, given that deep expertise. And so sometimes that can be really difficult to try the new and to take on the new, and trying to get over that hurdle can be a challenge. So one of the techniques that maybe I've tried in the past is to actually show that we don't really lose anything by trying something out. And if we can keep the scope of something small, we should just try it, right? Because we say we know based on theoretical examination of a technology, but we don't really know until we try it. And so it's trying to bring an entrepreneurial spirit to what we're trying to drive with digitalization, and seeing if, you know, if we can learn more by doing and how that challenges us. Because at the end of the day, if we have the best tech, then we'll ultimately find that other technology that we're trying won't work. But if we don't, then we've potentially found something that could change the way we work, change the way we think about the science that we do. And that, in my opinion, is a win either way, right? You either prove that your technology is superior, or I helped you to prove that there's actually technology out there we really need to be paying attention to. So that's coming very much from a scouting kind of mindset and how we build these external partnerships. But there's so much happening in the world outside of the four walls of our company that we have to be open to looking at those types of things and help our deep experts figure out how that can be a part of their expertise.
And that segues really nicely to my next question. So, you know, we're seeing that partnerships seem to be a necessary element of digitalization, you know, and given your kind of scouting and your digitalization hats, you know, what makes a good partnership in this situation? And what are some warning signs that you're in a less than successful partnership?
Yeah, I like this question a lot, and not just because of my role, but I think because fundamentally, to make the types of advancements that organizations should be trying to make right now with digitalization, it takes partners. You can't do it all. It's just not possible. And your domain, whatever it might be, actually has players you probably don't even realize are out there. So partnering is a great way to go. So I think it's a fundamental key to success, just being able to do it. But a good partner, I think, is a couple things. One, I always look at the management team and what their direction is. Are they really business focused? Do they really see that there's a market in what they're trying to build? And it sounds maybe counterintuitive to think that way, but what I want to know is, what type of longevity does this company have? Is it just a really smart person with a good idea that has no idea how to monetize what they're doing, or how to provide that out to someone like me who is looking for a reliable supplier, or needs that to scale in a way that maybe that startup, for example, or that academic is not prepared to think about, right? I mean, at the end of the day, there are approximately 115,000 people in my organization, 10,000 approximately of which are researchers. And so I need these technologies to scale and be available to people regularly. And so by assessing the management team and their sophistication on what they've done really helps me to understand whether that's going to be a successful partnership or not. And, you know, maybe an example of that is that I work with a company whose business model shifted 3 times in about 12 months. And maybe the first thing you would say is that's a red flag, right? I don't really want to work with a company who figures out how to monetize what they're doing. But interestingly enough, what I saw was that their model was actually becoming more sophisticated and I think more tangible as they went. They went from a company who wanted to sell me licenses to their software to a company that ultimately wants to share in downstream revenue. That may not be as palatable to me in terms of a business decision, but it shows a maturity and a sophistication to that particular company that actually made me more interested to work with them because they're thinking about their business. They're figuring out how to pivot and respond to what they're finding in the marketplace. And so that for me is a good indicator of a good partner. And the interesting point about that, or at least I find interesting, is that you notice I didn't really talk about the technology. I talked about the people again. That was not intentional. It's kind of falling out. But when you're investing in a partner, you're really investing in that relationship and what that team can deliver to you. I truly believe most tech issues can be overcome unless it's a fundamental flaw in the tech or too early stage. But you can kind of assess that a little bit easier than you can the people element of the relationship. Another element of a good partnership is how well funded they are. Are they bootstrapped or are they really taking on investors? And that can go either way. Investors are going to want returns, so they may be driven by more the money element, which can be to your advantage or disadvantage depending on how much funding they've received. Bootstrapped companies oftentimes are better partners because they really are trying to do this on the revenue that they're getting from you to do these things. And perhaps more willing to work in a little more depth for your topic. But flipping this now to the less than successful partnerships, I tend to find that the red flag for me is the CSO slash CEO in the case of a startup who hasn't figured out how to move away from the control of the business. That's a huge red flag for me. Because oftentimes this will happen in our conversations with startups where we talk at length about the technology, but you can see they don't have what I mentioned earlier, which was a path to market with what they're trying to bring out. And that can be dangerous, right? Because the CSO or the person, that founder, may have started it because they have a passion about that particular topic and they're good at it and they figured that can apply to different markets, but they don't really know what to do with it. And they need people around them to help them take it further. If they don't have that supporting team, I really feel that's a pretty big indicator of a failure, of a potential failure. And so I would shy away from something like that. I would also shy away from, and this is always a big red flag, companies who tend to promise that their technology is so generally applicable as to not be applicable to anything anymore. I hear this pretty regularly. I was joking a little bit when I said that there's all these companies out there who promise me a model or an algorithm that could change everything in chemistry. But when we challenge some of that and they shift and they say, well, oh, but we could also do this and we could do this, I'm not looking for a Swiss Army knife, right? There has to be some sort of balance of being really good at that one thing that you're going to do and that we're interested in you for versus trying to meet every demand that a company can put on you. I just don't think you can be successful as an enterprise or even as an academic if you think you can apply it so broadly that it's stretched too far. So those would be really good, clear indicators up front of what to do or what I would see as red flags.
All right. So shifting gears a little bit, sustainability is often seen as something that's a nice to have. How can you see moves toward digitalization changing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a couple ways we can think about this. We can think about sustainability of the types of equipment necessary to do digitalization. So there's ways in which you could think about sustainable power sources. There are actually groups that are thinking about sustainability in terms of computation, right? So we have something like Curiosity, where it's actually far more sustainable within our walls than I think it is actually outside of our walls, as an example. But we can also think about sustainability of what of how this technology is impacting markets or impacting products. So I think digital agriculture, for example, is an area where we're seeing a much a move toward understanding more precisely what's happening inside a field for a farmer, and how technology can drive the more targeted application of products that we have, for example, or the right types of products that we have. So it's called precision agriculture, and it's something that I think is one way in which we're thinking about sustainability, right? Long-term, rather than blanketing areas with particular products, you might actually want to only hit certain parts of a field with a product. And that's better environmentally, better for the farmer, and hopefully will help to increase their yield long-term. But that's a direct derivation of digital technologies. And there's so much happening inside of agriculture. It's actually quite quite amazing, because we think about precision agriculture, but there's sensors to measure waterfall, there's sensors to measure soil composition. So you think about all that data together, and it's the perfect opportunity for a more sustainable future with digitalization. It also happens in other places, you know, process performance, how we can learn more about how we do things and do it more efficiently. BASF is known for our Verbund approach, which is very much about how we integrate our plants and how we can manage downstream processes to become upstream processes for different products. And so, you know, the more we understand about that from a digital perspective, the data that we can crunch and the insights we can gain, we're going to be more efficient about that and naturally be much more sustainable. So I actually think digitalization is a key component for sustainability, and how hopefully we as a society will eventually try to solve a lot of these really challenging sustainability problems.
Really interesting. So, you know, most of our members are still trying to figure out what data is the right data to capture. So with the current emphasis on the capture and use of data, what tips do you have for getting it right?
Yeah, great question. Getting data right is not an easy task. I think what's fascinating is that, again, the dream is that you find the perfect algorithm that can read this internal data that you have, and you find that diamond that you didn't know you was already part of your data set, and you can go and take it and monetize it, and you'll find the next big product in the next market. And in reality, I think what happens is you find parts of data that you're interested in one silo, and then maybe across in another silo, you might or you might not find data that can actually apply. You may be astute in thinking that you should apply some publicly available data, so you might try and bring that together, but that you find once you have all that data, you actually don't understand it, because perhaps people either didn't have a complete enough data set, so they didn't collect all the information that they should have, or the data that was that you found actually doesn't have a lot of descriptors or metadata to help you understand what that data is actually supposed to mean or the context in which it was gathered. And without that, it's really hard to make any sense of what that data can be. So really, I would recommend, to the extent that you can, a decision point for yourself is what's the ROI? What's the value of looking into the past versus going forward? Do you say that could yield something, but you have no idea? So you look backwards and figure out how to fix that data. I have a feeling that journey is going to be very difficult. Or do you kind of say, look, we realize that we need to be better at data collection and data preparation, right? So having clean data, that we really need to focus on more complete data sets and collecting as much data as we can about the context and as many discrete data points in one setting as possible going forward. It's a tough decision point, right? Because again, I think there's this romanticism around the idea of you can find something hidden in your old data that you wouldn't be able to find otherwise, that these new technologies enable that. To a certain degree, that's true, But I think you have to make a value-based argument there and really determine, is it worth the effort to try and go back? How much time will be spent trying to fix that data? Because I guarantee you, it's not clean in the way you think it should be, unless you are one of those miraculous organizations that has been collecting data properly for the past 20 years or longer in the case of SafeBS. It's just you have to kind of draw a line in the sand. But then going forward, you really need to make sure that you make that data openly available to as many people as you can. I firmly believe that. MIT was actually undertaking this as well across all their labs by trying to create an infrastructure that allowed people to grab data from multiple places to try and run machine learning algorithms and other AI approaches to see what could be seen from that data. It's great because that's one challenge with data. You have to get access worked out. And then the next step is, what is this data, as I was referring to, what's the metadata around it? So having some governance around that and how to collect that data actually will pay benefits, I think, fairly quickly with new data that you won't get without having governance. And so you really need to think about that. Maybe as unpalatable as it seems to have a team of people that have to devote themselves to making sure the right data is collected, it's critically important. And I'll give you one quick example. It's a little generic, but I think it illustrates the point pretty well. If you have a column with a number in it, and then you have a column of units next to it so that you actually know what that is, how do you know that what I typed in there is actually what you think it is? So if I typed in MG, you would assume perhaps milligrams, but maybe it was actually something else completely that I was thinking of myself. Or I've actually seen a data set like this where people were measuring the output of a particular process in asterisks, right? And so the more asterisks they had, the better, or so I thought. It might actually be the less asterisks, the better, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what an asterisk really is. So if you don't have rules around that, I think you end up finding that long-term, that data you throw out, and then you have to ask yourself, do I reproduce that data set? Is it even relevant anymore? And this kind of leads me right back to where I was talking about, do you cut and forget about past data and try to govern the way you do future data? I think those are really important ways in which you can get better data.
Wow, yeah. Okay, so.
It's not an easy process.
No, no, clearly not. So. Organizational and cultural change seem to go hand in hand with the digitalization journey. So what elements of this have you seen at BASF that have gone well, and you know, what hasn't gone well?
Yeah, this is a tough one. You know, I think kind of leading back to what I was talking about subject matter experts and researchers, in particular, is that we need to respect the idea that people have a depth of expertise in their field. You know, if you go out and you spend 5 to 7 years or longer in a PhD program and you've built a lot of depth around the topic, and then you come into an organization that now says, you know, you have this depth of expertise and we really like that, but also we have this tool that's going to make you go faster. So here, use this tool, go faster, don't worry about your expertise. You know, that's a huge challenge, and that doesn't always go well, because that sometimes flies in the face of the expertise or that sort of depth of knowledge the person has in the way that they look at a problem. You know, a tool, the sort of common feedback I hear sometimes is a tool is not going to solve my problem, and they're right to a certain degree, but also that open-mindedness to this is something you have to help people along with. I think training has gone well. I think we really spend time trying to bring people up to speed on these topics and to help them embrace it. And I think that is a huge element to being successful in any types of changes that way. I think also we had announced that, you know, we've put our IT with our digitalization together. And so you can then ask, well, what's the difference between IT and digitalization? And this is a fundamental thing you want to get right. IT is really about that sort of infrastructure and foundational components that you need to do digitalization, right? Digitalization is those things that sit on top of that help you with the insights. You need to make sure you really think about separating those two in terms of how you go forward, but bringing them together creates synergies that I don't think you get otherwise. And so I think that is a is a good way to move forward. I think it will help with speed to delivery on these new initiatives.
Okay. And you know, a lot of our members are faced with the question of how to get started in their digitalization journey. So how did BASF start?
So there was a, if you look back, I think there was some information published by the German government on Industry 4.0, which really talks about the digital revolution and what's happening. And that really became embedded in the mindset of people. And really, I think there was sort of two forces, right? There was a more formal force, which was based on this this idea of Industry 4.0. And that was set up as a project that would look at digitalization for BASF broadly. And then there was also ground up, or bottom up rather, pressure. There was a slide I saw from EY. This was many years ago. This was actually in the early 2010s, that I still think applies today. It was about talent and new talent coming into your organization. And they said, are you really going to hand me a BlackBerry and Windows XP when I come to your company? And I think at the time it was Windows 7 and iPhones. So to kind of give you that context, you have people who, when we talk about digital natives a lot, right? You know, you have people who are used to these tools in free form or maybe in a reduced form because they're coming out of academia or even in their personal life, you know, ask yourself how often it is that your phone's actually out of your hand. It's just a key part of how we work. And so an organization that can't manage that is going to suffer. And so you have that naturally, this bottom-up pressure. So we had both, right, to kind of push forward. We had sort of a top-down support through this project, and then we had the bottom-up pressure. The origin of how that happened, I think, was just environmental. It's what's being talked about, and it was the foresight of people in our executive management to really see that this was coming and to take on the challenge. That we should really think about this. But I think, Lee, you and I were talking about not so long ago, I thought about how even by the time we were taking it on, it felt like maybe, because that was, say, 5 years ago, felt like it was we were a little late to the game. And now I think about starting today, and I still feel like, you know, that would be even that much later because of the exponential speed of technology. So maybe one advice I would give you is, regardless of whether you have formal procedures for this now, start taking on some challenges. I mean, even if they're small and you're making even a skunkworks approach, depending on the size of your organization or funding that you have, go just take something on. Show people the types of insights that you can get from modern technologies and demonstrate the power of the technology that's available to you with smart people. And I think you can start to create that traction, and that would speak more to the bottom-up pressure.
So, you know, that kind of brings me to my next question, which is, you know, a lot of the challenges our members are seeing is, you know, getting C-suite buy-in. So, you know, I'm guessing that wasn't as much of an issue at BASF.
No, thankfully, no. I mean, there's still doubters, of course, and there always will be. And I think that's a healthy skepticism because it helps to challenge the directions that we go. But having C-suite buy-in is a huge component, I think, to being successful. And that, I guess, goes against what I just said about trying it. But I guess in the absence of it, you know, you have to kind of think a little more entrepreneurially and give it a shot. But having that support is critical. And actually, out of the six topic areas of our corporate strategy, digitalization is a key lever in that. So it's really ingrained into the culture, into the way people think about what we want to achieve. And so that's a message that has to come from the top, that has to be culturally absorbed, right? That we talk about this on a regular basis and you get key opinion leaders in the organization to continue to talk about it and to trumpet the possibilities that are available through digitalization. And through that constant messaging, I think that becomes part of the culture and you get then momentum behind that. But in the absence of it, again, as I was mentioning, taking on a more entrepreneurial approach can be a good thing, because one of the philosophies of looking at the outside world is we know that disruption is happening fast and furious. serious. And although disruption is a bit of a cliched word, it's, you know, we're seeing dramatic changes due to technology and to one of the key components of the modern technology landscape, which is democratization, right? I can now go out to Amazon, and as long as I have a credit card, I can access algorithms, I can access infrastructure that in the past was behind the walls of only those corporations that really had enough capital to invest in the types of technologies that you can get from Amazon, from Microsoft, from Google now, right? You can take the most basic example, look at Gmail. I mean, look at how prolific it is, or Maps, for example, that Google has out for everybody to quote unquote use for free, but there's no barrier to entry for that, right? You don't have to run your own email server. You don't have to manage any of that. And although it's an older example, it's sort of an illustration of how that infrastructure and how that capability is accessible to anybody. And we're seeing that happen even more and more when it comes to, for example, algorithms and coding, right? There's this concept of citizen development where you really think about the community of people out in the world who can contribute to a problem and solving it from a computational perspective. It's crowdsourcing, it's open source, it's all those movements, but so ubiquitous now and so available to people that it's so much easier for people to take on and to find an advantage that you don't, because when you figure you've got maybe 2 million eyes looking at a problem versus, you know, 5,000, you're probably going to miss something, and they're going to find something before you. So you want to pay attention to these things.
Mm-hmm. All right. So
I kind of went off the rails there from your original question. Did I get that what you wanted to know?
No, you did. You did. And I think you kind of answered it in the previous question too, you know, just kind of explaining the evolution of things at BASF. So I think we got you covered there. So, you know, based on what you've learned so far and all that you've been through at BASF, so what recommendations do you have for companies on their journey?
Get started. Don't wait. Don't wait for approval. Don't wait for the funding you think you need. Find ways to be creative with your funding. Just go out and take on a challenge, right? I'm sure you have problems in your organization that haven't been solved and or are challenging or need some form of visualization that's more accessible or could really provide some impact and it could be maybe taken on in a really easy way when you look at all these services that are available to you. Just don't wait. I think waiting is probably the single biggest problem with getting started with digitalization and believing that it's more than you know, the next set of servers you need to buy to support your ERP, right? Just go try it. Go try machine learning. There's so many ways in which you can do it. Get a couple of key people on your team to take it on and to learn about it. I think, you know, there shouldn't be any barriers to you going out and trying it. And really start to understand that speed is going to impact you in some way. And I think the next 10 years in particular are going to be really telling on how we see digitalization impact us. And so, you know, standing by the sidelines is giving up competitive advantage.
All right. That's a good way to end kind of the formal part of the interview. So we're going to open up the floor for questions. And while you guys mull over your questions, I do have one last question for Brian. And so that's, what does your team look like?
So we're a small team, the scouting team. There's about five of us. And we are regionally distributed. So we have a couple in North America, a couple in Germany. We're looking to broaden that more globally out to Asia as well. And so we really, we're small but effective. And we're a team of people that tries to think of big ideas with practical implications. So trying to balance the idea of big change and big thoughts with real ways in which we can try to provide value. So small but effective, I think is what our team looks like.
All right. And we're just waiting for some questions to come in here. I'm sure that there are lots of them. I'm sure I have not covered everything people wanted to know. So, all right, we've got one from JF Bartholomew. He's with NASA Langley, and I'm going to go ahead and unmute you, JF. All right, go for it.
Thank you. Thank you. Excellent brief. So I want to pick on your last recommendation, the recommendation, and you encourage everybody to get started, find ways to be creative. And when you are an organization that has a strong R&D component, you're likely to have people who actually have been doing digitalization for a long time in their own organization, in their own team, in their own project. And what it adds up to, if you look across the entire company, or in our case, agency, is that you've got a lot of different solutions to the same problem. And the implications for that is that the products are not necessarily compatible. And so you've created silos, as a matter of fact, because you have encouraged bottoms-up insights. And so I wonder if you faced that problem, and if you have, what have been some of the key approaches you've used to go from those silos of original solution to something that is actually of value enterprise-wide?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and certainly a problem. And you know, you're right, that sort of approach can create more siloing if it's not managed well. I think the opposite, though, is that you also standardize too much, and that you end up missing key components to your the possibilities of what your R&D teams can do by trying to standardize too much. I honestly don't have a good answer there, because it has to be a balance of some sort. We struggle with this, frankly. We talk a lot about how you can, you know, what's the right point to balance this, right? You ultimately are either going to have a too heterogeneous an environment or too homogeneous environment, or you're shifting the problem from multiple tools to a giant integration problem where you're trying to integrate all those tools and you spend all your time trying to integrate, and that ends up being exercise probably in very little value long term. I think there are technologies that you can start to address this with. You could look at things like data lakes as a way, at least from the data side, to try and manage that and to mitigate it, and using artificial intelligence to help you try and link this together. There's tools coming out of universities even now that are freely accessible that help to look at data landscapes, as an example, to help you find related data, even with missing some of the context I was talking about earlier. So at least from the data perspective, you can start to solve it. And I think some of the tools also that are built up around data lakes also help you to find insights across that data, even when you're missing some of the metadata. So you can start to create enterprise value without necessarily having to take away the tools from people that they like. But you can also, I mean, you could, if you wanted to, in a more project way or more formal way, is do a landscape of that and really try to find where you have redundancy and get people to move to a less heterogeneous environment. Maybe not strictly homogeneous, but maybe a less homogeneous where the integration story is less challenging.
Thank you.
All right, great. Sure. Thanks, Chef. All right, we have our next question is from Rajesh Mukherjee from Clorox, and he asks, we understood that Brian is part of a scouting team. What are the other components of BASF's R&D's digitalization team?
So I can't get into a ton of specifics about the organization, but we are, what I will tell you is this, is that we have three technology platforms within BASF. We have bioscience, material science, and chemistry. And our digitalization is connected very deeply back to each of those technology platforms. We also think more broadly about systems, and we think also about the sort of next generation, which is me, right? Me and my team thinking about scouting and partnerships. And so those are some of the components that we think about in trying to do that. And of course, we have some of the more classical components of IT, where you have infrastructure people and people who are thinking about application to business, right? So you can think in broad terms that would be some elements of how you could organize that.
All right, great. Thank you. And so we've got another one from Romulo Gayoso from Boeing, and it's about best known methods. So do you see any different BKMs from the European partners versus how we work here in the US?
Is BKM best known method?
Yes. I'm not sure I'm familiar with that. I think it's an acronym. BKM is, yeah.
Okay. And do you mind repeating the question once again?
Yeah, sure. So do you see any different best known methods from the European partners versus how we work here in the US?
That's an interesting question. I think technology, at the technology level, not as much. I think at a practice level, like in terms of how I work with or how we can work with people from those different regions, I find that there's a bit more openness in the European arena for how we collaborate and the ways in which we can define IP and the depth of the collaboration. So I do find that tend to be a little bit more open in Europe on that particular topic with businesses, and then also it tends to be a little less expensive outside of North America, as an example. But am I answering the question? I don't know. Maybe I'm not quite getting at the heart of it.
I'm not sure. We'll wait to hear from Rom. Right. I don't see any other question. Oh, he's raising his hand. I'm going to go ahead and unmute him so he can ask. All right, here we go. All right, Rom.
Hey there. Thank you very much, Brian, for doing this and sharing. It's wonderful when people share and we all learn. So you said, you know, we have people in Germany, you're here and you're expanding into Asia. And I was just kind of curious to think, well, is it because you think, you know, they contribute differently or the thought process is different? So what are the benefits of having a more diverse contribution?
Yeah, okay. Thank you. That clarifies it for me. I think actually diversity is key to this in thought and in approach. So for example, I think the Chinese government, what was it, two years ago, announced that they would be investing $100 billion in AI, right? That's breathtaking. So what are they doing with that? And how are they advancing it? And you know, does the way in which the Chinese approach problems and work toward problems benefit them in a way that we don't see necessarily in a region like the US, where maybe we see some government funding, but we also see a lot of private funding through investors. So I think it's slightly different models, and you really want to keep track of how people are progressing down those lines, AI being, I think, one of the critical topics. So there's, to me, huge value in understanding how Europe's approaching these problems, especially as a conglomerate in the EU, how they're really approaching something versus, say, how the US is approaching it, Canada, and then China, Japan, Korea, and others, Singapore as well. Singapore also announced a few years back that they were investing heavily in AI. So I think you really have to help yourself see those opportunities.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right, sure. Great. All right, we do have time for one more question. Does anyone want to jump in there? Oh, we've got a follow-up from JF. So JF was actually my first thought leader interview for this program. So, you know, we let him get away with a lot. All right, JF, go for it.
Thank you. It's not really a follow-up. Actually, it's a bit of a different question. And you may have started alluding to it in one of the prior response, but I might need help with this. I hear you are with R&D for BASF, and so I'm wondering, does R&D have a role to help demonstrate approaches that then end up being scaled to the entire company? Is that the model that you're following up? And if that's the case, what kind of lessons are you learning? Oh, right. Yes, in the scaling up to the to BASF at large.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think yes. The answer to that is broadly yes, depending on what the technology would be, of course. In some cases, we're not going to be working on technology that may be broadly applicable, right? So if we're doing scientific modeling, we're doing molecular modeling, or, you know, things like DFT calculations, those aren't the types of things that you would see have broad application across all segments of the company or all divisions of the company, but may have direct applicability to, say, business units that are interested in the types of outputs that could do. Some are going to be narrowly scoped like that, but there are others perhaps where maybe we're talking about statistical analysis or advanced statistical analysis or new methods of machine learning that actually do have some of that broad applicability, depending on the data or the sort of ways in which we think about data and managing that data that should have broad applicability across the organization. Scaling is hard. Scaling is a huge challenge in trying to bring that out to people. I think from a couple of perspectives, I think there's the human challenge, which I think I spoke to enough in the talk, that getting people to accept that and think about new ways to do that, and then the infrastructure to go through it. And so I think our teams being closely related to the infrastructure, the digital push, and the infrastructure people to help us build that, help us iterate fast around these potential technologies that can go across all BSF, and also help to make sure that we don't have that we can leverage the experience of leveraging of scaling something like an ERP or other systems where business continuity and redundancy are critical, right? So I think we actually, the best practice is really coming closer to your IT with those digitalization topics and working together to try and solve that problem, because you have different perspectives, right? Digitalization tends to want to go faster and fail fast and iterate. Whereas IT wants more stability in making sure that it can achieve those goals of stability. So I think bringing those two units together is a critical key to success.
Great. Thank you.
All right. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up. I want to thank all of you for your questions. And I want to give a big thank you to Brian for agreeing to be interviewed today. I hope it wasn't too painful.
No, really great. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. So I want to remind all of you to join us on March 19th for our next interview. And that's with Ananth Krishnan of Tata. And have a great afternoon. And again, thanks, Brian, for your time today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.